Hi, and welcome to Module 3, Branching Out. In this module, you're going to hear from physical therapists who are doing things outside of your traditional one-on-one patient care. And in this interview, I'm thrilled to have Chris Johnson. Chris completed his undergraduate studies at the University of Delaware, where he earned a Bachelor of Science with distinction while completing a senior thesis in the physical therapy department under Dr. Lynn Snyder Mackler. Chris was a member of the varsity men's tennis team, scholar athlete, captain in 2000, and recipient of the Lee J. Heinsick Award for Excellence in Athletics and Academics. He remained at the University of Delaware to earn a degree in physical therapy while completing an orthopedic sports graduate fellowship under Dr. Michael J. Axe of First State Orthopedics. Following graduation, he relocated to New York City to work at the Nicholas Institute of Sports Medicine and Athletic Trauma of Lenox Hill Hospital as a physical therapist and researcher. He remained there for 8 more years until 2010, when he opened his own facility, physical therapy and performance facility, Chris Johnson PT, in the Flatiron District of Manhattan. And recently, he has relocated to Seattle to further pursue his professional work while taking advantage of a more active outdoor lifestyle in the Pacific Northwest. And in 2014, he opened another physical therapy and performance facility, Zarin PT. In addition to being a physical therapist, Chris is a certified triathlon coach. Outside of his professional work, he races triathlons at the amateur elite level. He is a 3-time USAT All-American, 2-time Kona qualifier, and is currently ranked 16th in the country in long course racing. He is also extensively published in the medical literature and has a monthly column on Ironman.com, in addition to running his own video blog, and we're gonna talk all about that in this interview. So to learn more about him, please visit his website. Again, we'll repeat this later, which is Zarin, ZERENPT.com. So Chris, thank you. Welcome to the conference, and thanks for coming on.
Thanks, Karen. Thanks for having me. And it's always good to catch up with folks in New York.
Yeah, it's funny to move across the country to take part in a more sort of outdoorsy lifestyle, because it is hard in New York City to kind of get out and because you have to literally get out of the city.
Yeah, which is a feat unto itself. And I used to start thinking when I was resorting to going to Central Park to sort of soak up nature that, there's a problem there.
So, yeah,
I definitely miss it. It's an amazing city. And, you're obviously doing great things there, which is good to see.
Yeah. And, New York's a fun place. But anyway, on to the interview. So first off, Chris and I were sort of talking about this beforehand. And one thing I wanted to know is, what does Zarin mean in Zarin PT?
So I'll actually credit my mother for this particular idea. So, we were trying to brainstorm of names, and I knew I wanted to avoid naming it after myself. That works in New York because everyone in New York is like, oh, I got my guy or my gal that you should go see. But, I'm looking to grow something bigger, and, it was a very descriptive term. So a Zarin is a Mongolian gazelle that is essentially a decathlete of animals, but specifically runs fast and far, jumps high, and swims well. So, with my focus on multi-sport, especially triathlon, I thought that was perfect. So, I'm in the process of rolling things out under Zarin.
Yeah, and it's what a perfect blend of everything that you do all in one animal. So, great job on the name. Now, let's kind of continuing from that. Why don't you tell everyone a little bit more about your practice and kind of the stuff that you're doing there?
So my practice has morphed a lot. When I was in New York, it sort of started off as, just a simple concierge model, and I was rendering predominantly physical therapy. And now that I'm out here, I'm doing a combination of concierge physical therapy. I render one-on-one sessions, and I'm an out-of-network provider. But I also do a lot of performance coaching. So being certified as a tri-coach, it's sort of nice for people to connect with me because they know that I have a medical background. And if things are ever going south, that I'm in a good position to say, well, I think this is something we can manage conservatively, or we may need to get you in the hands of someone else. So my whole goal is to really capture people, well, prevent injury in the first place, but in the event someone comes to see me, to address any of their, you know, functional limitations or to address things from a pain amelioration standpoint, and then to slowly work them to back to all their activities, and then to start getting them actively training. And it's amazing. Most of the folks who connect with me really never leave the ecosystem, and in time, they only become more autonomous with managing their situation. So it's really empowering them more than anything, which is, you know, sort of a novel concept in this day and age.
And kind of going back to the triathlon coaching, can you tell us a little bit more about how you get to become a triathlon coach and how that has impacted what you do as a physical therapist?
I would say that my physical therapy, coaching and physical therapy are along a certain spectrum. I've always made it a point to keep up with the literature. That's just been a part of my influence, having spent time in Lynn Snyder Mackler's lab as well as at the Nicklaus Institute. So the certification is just important because you have to go through a process and, you know, you have to take a test at the end. And there are a few different certifications out there. The main one is the USAT. And there are three different levels to that. I did mine through the International Triathlon Coaching Association. But I think, you know, the most important thing is to stay on top of the literature, because everything in medicine and performance comes with a date. And, you know, that's something that we have a responsibility. If we're going to be offering a service or rendering care, that we have to stay current. So it's given me just one more different window into looking at people. But it's a slightly different focus from physical therapy because it's more performance based.
And that kind of takes me into the next question is, you know, like I said before, this module branching out is all about kind of going beyond your traditional one-on-one patient care that most people think of when they think of physical therapy. So you have a lot of interesting components to your practice, mm-hmm. aside from just that one-on-one care. So can you talk a little bit about those, sort of the running analysis, program design, the things that you do as a triathlon coach, and how that has, and how much of that, of your business is that?
I would say, yeah, it's definitely morphed. I was rendering, when I was in New York, predominantly physical therapy. I would say it was about an 80-20 split, physical therapy to running and triathlon coaching. So now that I'm out in Seattle, I would say it's almost 50-50. Again, I approach everyone who comes to see me as a physical therapist first and foremost, and I don't think one can help but to do that, having gone through our training. So I look at someone and say, you know, what's their past medical history? What are some of the risk factors? You know, really, what am I dealing with in terms of the person, you know, in terms of how they present, as well as who are they as a person? So by having all these different services, I basically give people choices. And I think that's what a lot of patients are looking for, or athletes. And, you know, the tricky thing is, where do you channel someone? Someone may want to come to see me for performance coaching, and I say, look, you know, I would love to do performance coaching with you, but I think that there are some physical therapy or medical considerations that need to be addressed prior to that, so you don't start, you know, barking up one tree only to get sidelined by injury. So, you know, and with the running analysis, with, you know, the triathlon coaching, it's just all part of, you know, a system that I have in place to, you know, to address people's needs. So, but I think people also trusted me a little bit more, knowing, again, that I'm a physical therapist and I'm not just looking at them from sort of a one-dimensional standpoint.
And how do you do running analysis? Do you do that only with people in Seattle, or are you doing that via online?
I do it both. It's more than just a running analysis. So running has very specific performance demands. So when I work with people remotely, you know, what I'll ask them to do is to go through a series of things. And that may be, you know, step downs. It may be looking at toe dexterity. It may be watching them walk, going through, you know, stuff like a freestanding squat. And at that point, I should almost be able to anticipate somewhat how they're going to run. And then I have the treadmill analysis to basically look at things in terms of their meaningful task. And it actually works out really well. I've had a lot of people who reach out to me for online consultation. And, you know, I was just speaking with a woman who's in North Carolina, who's back running better than ever. And I've never worked with her in person. And she is just like living proof that this can be done. And now with technology in place, it's easy to do. But I think a lot of times people rush to do a treadmill analysis when they're dealing with someone who's injured and they're seeing compensatory motions. And you have to be careful in that regard. You know, so I really try and keep that reserved for people who are actively training, who may be looking to refine their running. But at the same time, it's just sort of knowing who's reaching out for your help.
So if you're doing a consult with someone who's out of state, who you're not physically in front of, so it sounds like you have them kind of run through some specific motions first. Cool. That will videotape themselves, send it to you. You'll sort of look at those motions. Will you offer corrective techniques on these motions? If they're, let's say they're working with a physical therapist already, are you in touch then with their physical therapist, or is this, you know, how does this work?
I would say a lot of the times, and that's a great question, a lot of the times people are reaching out to me because they failed or had suboptimal outcomes with, you know, a range of medical professionals, trainers, who are in their area. Very rarely do I get someone right off the bat. It's usually I'm the last resort. And as I tell people, someone's like, oh, I had this easy patient the other day, or this easy athlete to work with. I'm like, I never see easy patients or athletes, you know, they just don't fall into my hands. So, but I absolutely will work with, if they're actively seeking care from a physical therapist, yeah, I'll definitely be in communication with them. And that's how a lot of these videos have started. And people always ask me why I do all these silent videos. And it's because I don't want to put a lot of verbiage to them, because they sort of stand alone. And if a therapist wants to use them, they can tell the patient what to focus on. You know, so I use it really to stimulate mirror neurons and to just have as a reference or sort of an instant replay where someone can go back and look at the model of performance. So.
And how do people find you?
That's a good question. I think partially from the old Tennessee Titans running back, Chris Johnson. But I think he's now with the New York Jets, if I'm not mistaken. But no, most people come across me through stuff online, which is awesome. I never thought I'd be sitting here at, you know, in my mid 30s recording video, playing like a child. And that's what put me on the map. You know, I sort of laugh every time I think about that. But the support that I've had online has been so incredible. And I think it's because I'm not pushing so much. I'm making suggestions. You know, people are getting a window into my philosophy or perspective. But, you know, a lot of these videos, it's just me practicing things, because I want people to have a good, reliable information source and also a good model of performance. You know, because I think when you see this, I'd like to think that, you know, I move pretty well at this point. But it's sort of like, you know, when I was younger, I would watch a professional tennis player and I would try to copy them. And that's sort of how these videos are being used now. And I'm in the process of rolling out a subscription service, which you and I discussed briefly, where I start going into a lot of the science, the rationale, the progressions to this stuff, because I sort of just throw them up there randomly.
And how did, I want to talk about these videos. So you have countless videos with thousands and thousands of views on YouTube, mm-hmm. right? So when did you, so first of all, when did you start doing them? How long ago? And then we'll talk into how you physically record them.
Okay.
And kind of put them together and that kind of stuff. But let's start out with, when did you start recording them?
And that's a great question. It's I started taking pictures first. And I have a friend in New York named Gary Vaynerchuk. And he's sort of a social media legend at this point. He's sort of a Tony Robbins of our generation. And I read his book called Crush It and another one called The Thank You Economy. And I just started realizing that I had all the resources. There's really no cost associated with doing this. And I had so much information I wanted to get out there. So I started writing a lot initially and got some good feedback. But what I've noticed is that people's attention spans just very short because we're inundated with so much information. So I said, how can I deliver this stuff, providing meaningful information in a time efficient manner? And I just started doing essentially what became vignettes. And I never want to pull people away from what they're doing, you know, or have them look at one more site. So I said, if I can, my criteria are, it's got to be relevant. There's got to be a specific focus, and it has to be for the most part under 1 minute. And I think New Yorkers got me conditioned for that. They're like, I have literally 1 minute to do something. I'm like, 1 minute, you know, not 90 seconds. So I just started really making them brief, and it forced me to really be concise and think about what I was putting on video. And I also realized as I was starting to do this that a lot of how I thought I was moving was different once I saw it on camera. So camera is it's very humbling. So I use it to refine my movement, and I practice this stuff every day. So when you see these clips, a lot of it's me practicing, refining my own movement, but sharing it with the online community. Some of the times it's maybe one or two takes. Sometimes it may be 10 takes until I get it right. But that's sort of what I think patients go through when they're learning these exercises, you know?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a learning curve. No one gets a new exercise and does it perfectly right out of the gate.
Not at all.
You know, so it's actually refreshing to hear that you don't do this in one take and you're done.
Well, the marching drills I do. So, but there are some other drills. I'm learning this like 2-to-1 lateral skipping, and I'll post this. I'll post it after we finish this session, just so people see. This is something that took me about, I would say, 8 to 10 trials before I got one that, you know, I was pleased with, and it's still not perfect, and I'll continue to work it. So, yeah, it's all about refining things, and, you know, mastering certain skills.
Yeah. And I mean, I know I try and catch as many of those videos as I can, because I find them to be so helpful when I'm working with my patients, you know, and I use them kind of like you said. You sort of, I can add my narrative to what the patient needs at that time. And using those exercises, I feel like, has been very helpful, because I think all PTs and all people, for that matter, can sometimes, you sort of, you know, you keep up with as much as you can, but it's nice to get like a refresher, and it's nice to get something new. And so I think that's the real advantage that you're giving PTs or personal trainers or athletic trainers with your videos. So I think, thank you for that, because I think it keeps you thinking, you know, you're not getting stuck in that rut.
Well, that's good to hear. I mean, that sort of validates everything that I'm trying to work on. So, and I put this stuff out there, like I said, as a free resource, and that way people across all these different professions can use it. So, because the second you start talking in technical terminology, it very quickly alienates people, but it also distracts you from the visual component of the video. So, no, I'm glad to hear that you're using them. And there is a lot of, these are very, they're seemingly trivial exercises, but they're very in sync with all the medical and performance literature. So,
yeah, and I think what you do a good job of is simplifying these exercises and these moves. Like you said, you want to keep it under a minute. You know, it's much harder to simplify. And by simplify, we don't mean dumb down. Mm-hmm. By simplify, we mean streamline and really be very intentional and precise with what you're doing. So to keep something at under a minute, it's very, very hard to do. You know, it's very hard to streamline and simplify. I think, you know, David Butler and Lauren Mosley just came out with their new book, The Protectometer, so the Explain Pain Handbook, which is really a simplified version along with a lot of new material. But David Butler said it was harder writing this than it is to write papers that are being accepted in peer-reviewed journals.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, it really forces you to just get down to the essence of what is it you're trying to communicate.
So. And where are all of these videos? Are they all on your own YouTube channel?
Yeah, so I started my own YouTube channel, and I never take things down. Because I look back at these videos, and there's a whole evolution to, you know, to where I am at this point. So, you know, I want people to understand that I go through a learning process just like patients and athletes. So I never will pull things down just because I think they don't look up to snuff, or, you know, I was doing something that may have, you know, violated research that we know about nowadays. So, you know, this stuff is, as I say, everything in medicine, you know, and performance comes with an expiration date. So, but I'm shooting these at a place called Harriet Sports Performance, and that's, I sublease space from them right now. And it's fun. I mean, they walk in sometimes, whether it's the owners or the customers, and they see me doing all these videos, and I don't know what they think of me, but it's fun. You know, they're always giving me a hard time.
And do you have someone who is physically shooting you, or are you just doing this yourself?
No, I do all this myself. So what I do is I hit record, run over in front of the backdrop, which is really cool. And it's very, you know, consistent with, you know, I guess my athletic involvement with the swimmer in the back. And then I'll take a look at it. So I'm starting to audit, you know, or edit my own motion, and then I'll pull it into my computer and then pull it into iMovie, cut it and finalize it and put it on YouTube. I mean, it's amazing. The system's in place now. So I'm very lucky that they position me to use the space, and, you know, that I have the health and knowledge base to put this stuff out there.
Yeah. And I think it's important for the people listening to this in this conference to know that, you know, the technology is there. Like, absolutely. What you do is a great example of how a physical therapist can use the technology that's there for the taking, and that's free, for the most part, free, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
To sort of position yourself as an expert in your niche within the field, and to just grow your business, and to kind of, like you said, you're at a 50-50 split now of one-on-one patient care versus a lot of this other running analysis and performance design and things like that. So how much do you think those videos have contributed to your perhaps getting clients that are outside of the physical therapy care?
They've played an invaluable role. And I've never done any marketing where I'm chasing people down. I really try and just put out quality information. And I think what happens with these videos is, someone once told me, they said, look, you know, to be successful in any field and in life, you have to be interested and interesting. And I think that what really shows with these videos is I'm very passionate about the field of physical therapy, about, you know, multi-sport, and about performance. And you don't even need to ask. I mean, people are like, when do you find time to do all these videos? I love it. I mean, that's a playground for me. So this is again, played such an invaluable role in marketing at no cost. So, and this stuff is, it's on the internet essentially forever, you know, unless something happens. So,
right.
They've played a huge role. And like you said, there's no upfront costs or anything. So, you know, I think you have to just get comfortable being in front of a camera, but that comes with practice, you know?
Yeah, that absolutely comes with practice. I mean, I can attest to that, you know, and just doing this conference and other various things that I've been doing via YouTube. It does take a little time, and there's certainly a learning curve. But I love how you said, I'm not taking down the videos I did in the beginning.
Yeah, absolutely not.
Because it does show that learning curve, and it shows sort of your evolution, mm-hmm. you know, and that medicine and therapy and performance does change as new research comes out and new methods come out. So I think it's important to keep all of that up there. And I also love, you know, what, just as a side note for people, when I started doing this conference and putting all these videos together, I do the same thing. I take these videos and I put them into iMovie. And as I was sort of putting title cards and end cards on, I looked at one, and it was the one that you use for your for your videos. And I was like, that's how he does it. Because I always wonder, I'm like, how's he doing this? This is so professional looking. And it doesn't take much to look very professional.
Yeah, and I think with video, you know, it's very important to keep a clean, clutter-free background. And, you know, that was always a challenge in New York because space is, you know, tough to come by. So, you know, out in Seattle, I always laugh when people are like, oh, you know, we need a bigger space. I'm like, you have 10,000 square feet. What do you need? So, yeah, but with video, you don't need to, again, spend an arm and a leg. I have a professional camera at this point. It's a Nikon D7000. Though, you know, some of these videos that I've shot are with my iPhone. And the technology has come so far that you don't need to drop a lot of money, and you can essentially do all this stuff on your own. And I was showing my work to a professional videographer yesterday, and he was just like, I can't believe you have 500 videos and they look like this. You know, and he said, yeah, the lighting, you know, could be improved, but he said, it's not taking away from your videos. So, so that was comforting to hear. But again, I think that people have sort of, someone told me the other day that I've become a video expert, and I laughed. I said, I'm not a video expert. Maybe I'm a movement expert, that it looks good on video at this point, but I'm far from some, you know, savant with technology. So, but you demystify this stuff the more you do it. So.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, another thing that I want to talk about that you sort of do in your practice is program design. Mm-hmm. So sort of designing programs for endurance athletes. Is that mm-hmm. correct?
Correct.
So how does that work within your practice? And again, is that something that you're doing online, or is that an in-person thing?
So there are people that work with me in person, but, you know, I have a lot of clients that are scattered across the world, and I do coaching remotely. So, you know, the first thing to understand, again, is I think one of the challenges for someone, you know, in my position is saying, is this a patient or a client that we're working with? You know, and it's a fine line when you start getting into the endurance sports, because people don't want to, you know, shut down. So, you know, I always say, am I doing this to address functional limitations and pain amelioration? Because if that's the case, they need to be working with a physical therapist in person for the most part. So these are typically healthy people, not that they aren't without risk factors, but I try and just sort of make sure I understand who I'm dealing with, what their past medical history is. So I really spend a lot of time talking to them before we start training. So, but I'll send people weekly programs, and again, it's predominantly related to running and triathlon, where it sort of takes any guesswork out of the equation for them. You know, the tricky thing is in life, things pop up, so you also have to be loose. So a lot of how I work with athletes is to give them a framework or principles. You know, and I say, look, if you have a work commitment that keeps you out late, you know, stress equals stress equals stress. You know, so if you wake up and you're not feeling too motivated to train, you have to dial it back or go for a walk that day. So it's definitely challenging. It's helpful for me as being a physical therapist, because I can infuse a lot of these exercises and drills that we were just discussing that are on video. And that way I plug those into their training. But with triathlon, even though it's, you know, it is a form of cross training, triathlon is a triple threat for injury. Because you have swimming, where people tend to deal with shoulder injuries. You have cycling, which is neck and low back, not to mention trauma. And then you have running injuries, which are really knee and distal. So, you know, it's a juggling act. And you have to really stay current with people and make sure that you have very, very clean communication lines. So...
And do you have any screening systems in place when you are sort of, like you said, you spend a lot of time talking to these potential clients. Do you have certain screening programs, or do you use any measures to detect if that person perhaps needs physical therapy or needs further evaluation by a person in where they are versus just, you know, giving them a program?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's important that if this is a physical therapy or a medical issue, that they need to address that. to the best of their abilities. So, because my greatest concern is to start working with someone only for them to get sidelined by injury and enter the medical system and fall under the care of someone who I don't have good communication lines with. You know, there are things such as the FMS and the SFMA that are out right now. Am I using those with endurance athletes? No. You know, I think that there's still research that needs to come out. And there, look, people are doing some great research trying to really, you know, figure out the relevance and validity of these systems. But I have sort of screens that I've developed in questionnaires. So that way I really know who's falling into my hands as a coach. But again, you know, if someone's, for example, having a tough time with stair negotiation or squatting to get into a cupboard, they're really not going to be well positioned to start training 6-7 days a week, swimming, biking, running, you know. And I would say that's relatively common. That's a lot of the patients that come to see us as physical therapists. So, and a lot of times people are in a denial process about that. So, you know, there's the psychological aspect of this too. So, but you have to take a really hard line because, you know, what you'll find, and I'm sure you can attest to this in New York, is people are not always sensible. And I tell all the athletes I work with, you know, and I don't take everyone on just because they want to work with me and pay me. I only take on people who are sensible, that understand my approaches, because, you know, I want to make sure that they're not creating a strike against themselves for, you know, in the event they want to, you know, play with their grandkids or, you know, just later in life. This is about longevity. It's not about, you know, rushing to failure.
And can you expand a little bit on that rushing to failure?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the things that any patient who's worked with me will tell you, they'll say, Chris is always adamant about not violating the RTF rule, which is rush to failure. You know, because we can get instantaneous results with a lot of things in life these days, nothing could be further from the truth when it comes to athletic development. You know, so I'm in my mid-30s right now, and people say, oh, how long did it take you to master some of these drills? And I'm like, oh, about 30 years. And they look at me like, 30 years? I say, yeah, well, this is a process, you know? But I think that it's not solely a function of the accelerated rehab programs that, you know, that are common, but I want people to revel in the process because I think that's the most important piece. And, you know, with a lot of the post-surgical patients that I worked with, I said, look, let's just dial things back a little bit. You know, I would rather you know, be patient and have a better outcome than trying to, you know, again, rush to failure only to have prolonged your recovery, you know?
Yeah. I mean, and that makes a lot of sense, and I'm glad that you kind of cleared that up. So it's, you know, so it sounds to me like you have sort of screens and questionnaires in place so that when someone is contacting you that lives in another part of the world or another part of the country, that you can kind of say to yourself, you know, this is someone that I think I can work with at this point in their training, or perhaps this is someone that I may say, I would love to work with you in the future, but right now it sounds like you need A, B, or C. Is that correct?
Absolutely. And I tell them that I'm here to, you know, to consult. And if you're working with a physical therapist, chiropractor, whoever the case may be, feel free to reach out. You know, I think in healthcare, the thing that's really falling by the wayside is communication. And that's been the biggest challenge for me being in Seattle, is that when I was in New York, I could pick up the phone and call a handful of the top doctors in New York across different disciplines, and they would pick up the phone right off the bat. So, and it just, it bridged that whole communication dilemma that, you know, we oftentimes fall, you know, are subjected to.
And I know that you are also very much a part of the more biopsychosocial approach to care.
Absolutely. So,
of course, as we all should. But yeah. How do you incorporate that approach to patient care into the approach, or do you incorporate that into the people or the clients that you're seeing for program design, for running analysis, and all that kind of stuff?
Yeah, and what I do a lot of the times is, and I think it's critical, and but people think with the biopsychosocial model that we're really downplaying biomechanics, and that's the furthest thing from the case. You know, it's plugging it into a bigger picture. You know, because one of the talks that I do is on basically a framework to approach managing injured runners. And how do we explain someone who breaks all the rules yet is winning the race? And what that sort of shows you is the biomechanics in this case, you know, it's not they excessively pronate, so they're going to develop, you know, medial tibial stress syndrome. So you have to put this into context. These runners who present with these deviations may have just allowed such a long time for adaptation where they never created, you know, a situation of pathology. So, and then you have someone like Ryan Hall who just has pristine form, yet he's not necessarily the one winning the race. I mean, he has won plenty of races. So Greg Lehman's done a great job. He has an ebook. I have people glance at that. And he's awesome in that he puts all this stuff out there for free. You know, we owe him a lot for doing so. But it's really in how you talk to people more than anything. And I think that's what is a takeaway when you start getting into David Butler and Lorimer Mosley stuff. It's how they phrase things when they're working with people, you know? And I always tell the triathletes that I'm working with, you know, I just came from seeing a fellow who's racing Ironman Texas, and he reached out to me because he's dealing with some medial-sided foot and ankle pain. And I say, look, you know, you're in a safe place. You did not get hit by a car. There was no trauma. So this is good. I mean, this is a simple, you know, it's a non-traumatic situation. You know, fortunately, you have good health, you have the resources and the intelligence to get after this. And thanks for reaching out, because it's all about being proactive. And it's these little ways of, it's communication, nothing more than that. But I think what happens a lot of the time is when someone comes to see a physical therapist, they immediately think we're going to shut them down. And we're saying, oh, here's another crazy runner. So, you know, when someone comes to see me, I'm typically just getting off the treadmill or I'm in the process of training. So they sort of already have bought in, you know, and I say, oh, look, I've dealt with that. This is a very common thing. So you start to mitigate threat, you know, and say, look, I actually think you're good. I would say dial things back for a couple of days and then let's plug you back in, because there's no reason not to. Everything else checks out. So.
Yeah. And I think it's important that you said it, the biopsychosocial model doesn't take out the bio. You're still evaluating the patient from a, you know, biological or biomedical standpoint, but you're not stopping there.
Yeah.
And I think that's the difference, you know, you're not stopping there. You're communicating with the patient, you're talking with them, you're trying to find out, you know, a little bit more about what is going on and mitigating threat. And sometimes, you know, I would assume if, as you ramp up your training, perhaps some things might be normal.
Sure.
Within that ramping up phase. And I think if you can mitigate the threat from that standpoint, I think it can make a big difference.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other thing I teach a lot of folks who come to me for mentoring or who attend courses, I say novice athletes are more fragile, you know, and that's a really important reminder. You know, for someone like myself, I may have some discomfort, but I clearly know when I need to dial it back. I mean, if I'm running and I start altering my mechanics and I'm dealing with unfamiliar, disconcerting pain, that's easy. I just start walking, you know, and I may try running, you know, after a minute or two. And if I get pushed back again, I pull the plug on the workout, you know, and that's what I mean by being sensible. You know, I think people, if they have one day off, they feel like they're going to lose fitness and their performance is going to be compromised. And, you know, if you talk to any world-class endurance athlete at the end of their career and you say, what would you have done differently? You know, it's almost unanimous. They say, I would have rested more. You know, so.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's just great advice. And I love that novice athletes are more fragile. I think that's a great comment. So Now let's go on to what is next. So you're doing all this great stuff. You're using technology to really enhance your practice. You're thinking outside of the box. You're doing a lot of things that are fun. It sounds like you sort of found your niche. You're doing what you love to do. It shows. You're expanding on that. So what's next?
Retirement.
Of course. Of course. You've made your millions and that's it.
No, far from it.
40, see ya.
Far from it. No, I'm hustling my tail off. Uh-huh. I think people who see my presence online think that I'm just traveling around and, you know, making all this money with, you know, Con Ed and racing. And I'll tell you what, it has been such a hustle having moved to Seattle. I walked away from a situation in New York where people would think I needed my head examined. I had basically a flowing practice. I could show up. It was, you know, a very motivated group of people. I had the top docs in the city sending me their friends and their families and, you know, colleagues. And so I walked away from that, and I'm okay with that. I think, you know, opening up new chapters is important. That's part of life. So, but Seattle is very different. I guess what's next out here is I want to really expand my facility. And I want it to be a combination of physical therapy and performance coaching, because my goal is to get athletes and take them from an injured point back to training and racing. And it's really empowering when they revel in that process. And I'm going to start a subscription service up soon where I go into detail, because one of the challenging things with Con Ed anymore is that a lot of budgets are being, you know, decreased, or people just don't have the financial means to, you know, to give these huge Con Ed budgets or stipends. So online learning is really, I think, the next big thing. And it's here. So I'm trying to just get this information out to people in a cost-effective manner. So I'm looking to start up a subscription service in the next month or two. And I want to have a full-blown performance facility out here with physical therapy, research, and a performance end of it. So that's sort of what I'm focusing on. At some point I'll look to start a family. So, you know, I can't imagine. I'll finally have an assistant when I'm doing these videos. So, you know, but I continue to shoot all these videos. I want people to see training through the ages. It's really, aging as an athlete is, it's an eye-opening experience. You know, and you have to be very loose with how you train. What worked for you 10, 15 years ago may not work at all anymore. So
yeah, and I feel as physical therapists, don't you hear that all the time? Yeah, I had a patient who had an ACL, and he was ACL reconstruction, and he was in his late 30s, almost 40. And he said, you know, I used to be able to, you know, do X, Y, and Z and play all these games. And I was like, well, when? He's like, well, you know, when I was in college.
Yeah.
And he was a collegiate athlete. He was a D1 collegiate athlete basketball player.
Yeah, legitimate athlete.
Yeah, totally legit. And it's like, yeah, you know, when you start, as you age as an athlete, I think it's great to continue to have that passion for what you do and the love of your sport. But I think considerations certainly need to be made, because what you did, even for you, who's a basically almost an elite athlete, amateur elite, I'd say elite, but an elite athlete, I'm sure what you did 15 years ago may not be what you're doing today.
No, it's very different. But you know, you can also continue to be very active over the course of your life if you maintain some level of consistency and you're reaching out to people who, you know, are experts in their respective fields. So I spend a lot of time, and you know, someone asked me the other day if I have any advice for them to develop as a physical therapist. I said, yeah, go spend time with a lot of folks outside of your discipline who are also experts in their field. You know, just to see how they approach things, their thought process, systems that they may be using, how they communicate with people, you know, how they juggle work-life balance, just all in. So
yeah, and actually that kind of takes me to the last question I was going to ask you is what advice would you give to physical therapists who are thinking of kind of branching out and they're thinking of moving beyond the traditional one-on-one care?
I would say wherever your mind goes, pursue it. Provide that you're deliberate and your message is genuine. But you know, it really, when I talk to people who aren't doing something that they're passionate about, that really scares me and concerns me. You know, and you hear a lot of negative chatter, and I think these thought viruses are very unhelpful. So, you know, I would say, look, venture out. Don't be afraid of failure. You know, and that's so cliche to say, but there's a lot of very talented folks in the world, but you know, there's some brilliant people, and I would say trust your instinct. And if someone is not supportive of it, just nod your head. Don't waste any more time or energy, you know? But also you have to be doing something every day, even if it's a half hour, to work towards whatever your goals are. And to make sure that you also write down things as you achieve them. I think we try to conquer so much. And if you just, you know, I always at the end of every year, you know, will say, what are 5 to 10 things that I was really happy about? And you start saying, wow, I've actually accomplished a lot. You know, because when you're in the day-to-day trenches, you feel like, you know, you may be spinning your wheels. I know that's been the case since I moved out to Seattle. But I'm like, well, wait a second. You know, I've done quite a bit. I shouldn't be so tough on myself. And I think, you know, to really surround yourself with people who are supportive, that are upbeat, motivated, and take care of themselves from a health standpoint. You know, that's always, I work a lot around all these performance cyclists and really performance junkies in Seattle. And it's amazing. I mean, they push me, you know, to be my very best. So, you know, with physical therapy is changing a lot. Acknowledge that, understand that we have never been in a better point in time with all the technology and the resources, and never hesitate to ask people for their help or, you know, their input on things. But I think people genuinely, you know, are very well intentioned and want to help you, and they'll support you if you branch out and you're doing something that seems like it's a bold move. That attracts people. They want to rally and get behind that. So,
yeah, I agree. And I think especially in the physical therapy world, I think physical therapists, we just innately want or inherently want other physical therapists to succeed.
Yes.
You know, why wouldn't you? It's good for the profession as a whole, you know? And I think what I always think is with social media and a lot of, like you said, chatter on social media, and some of it can be a little negative or tacky or something like that towards one person or another, I think it's really important to kind of align yourself with those people who share your same values.
Yeah.
And you know, who are successful or who want to be successful.
Sure.
Because what ends up happening is you're propelled forward by the people who are around you. You know, one of my friends once said, it's, you know, a lot of times you are judged even by yourself and by others, by the company that you keep.
Yeah,
very and true. And I think that you're motivated by the company that you keep. So I agree with everything that you just said before. You know, as great piece of advice for people who are thinking of branching out is find people who are doing it. Find people who are interested in the same thing you are, and they're there to help.
Yeah, and I always want to help people avoid some of the mistakes or pitfalls that I've made. You know, and, you know, it's amazing. I'll have a lot of folks that reach out to me and they're not expecting an email back. And, you know, when they get one within 24 hours, you know, I think that's encouraging for them. So, but sometimes it can be overwhelming, but at the same time, you know, I encourage people to, you know, if they have ideas, to pursue them, you know, because you're going to learn something if it succeeds, you're going to learn something if it fails, and not to, to shy away from that. You know, I would say that, look, as a physical therapist, I get, you know, I'm lucky to work with a motivated group of people, but I've had plenty of patients who in my mind have had suboptimal outcomes, but those are the folks who I've really learned a lot from. You know, it's easy if I sneeze on someone and they get better, you know, because they probably would have gotten better on their own. It's the people who I always say, you know, I'm trying to take people from one standard deviation to the next, you know? But no, I'd encourage people to just go for it.
Yeah. And on that note, I think we are sort of running low on time here, but I just want to thank you so much for coming on and giving a lot of great advice and great inspiration. This module is all about being inspired. And I think, you know, I said this with a couple of other people I've interviewed for this. If you're not inspired by this, then, you know, I don't know what you're going to be inspired by. So thank you so much for coming on, Chris. I really appreciate it.
Oh, of course, Karen. Thanks for having me. And, you know, I look forward to seeing what you pull together here, and keep up the great work. You're a testament to what can be done. So, you know, you sort of brought a ton of very talented people together, and you know, I've taken note of it, and I've actually learned a lot from you, and you have a phenomenal on-camera presence too.
Well, thank you very much, and everyone watching, thank you so much. Enjoy the rest of Module 3 and enjoy the conference.